Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, a first all-sky map of the universe shows mysterious bubbles, extreme weather risks from climate change, and billions of planets possibly orbit red dwarf stars. Here's a scientist soundbite.
What the climate models consistently indicate is that a more energetic climate, a warmer climate, has more variability on all time scales, and you see that variability in extremes. Extremes of high precipitation, low precipitation, strong storms, things like that.
That's ecologist Chris Field. We'll have more with him later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
Filmmaker James Cameron's Deep Sea Challenger re-emerged from its record-breaking dive into the deepest known point in Earth's oceans on March 25th. Cameron is the first human being to reach the bottom of the Challenger Deep of the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific, which is 6.8 miles or 11 kilometers deep.
The sun's atmosphere can generate tornadoes that are several times as wide as planet Earth. Now, a movie of solar tornadoes was presented at the National Astronomy Meeting 2012 in Manchester on March 29th. You can see it at earthsky.org.
Earth usually has more than one moon, say astronomers. Asteroids orbiting the sun might temporarily become mini-moons. When they do, they follow complicated paths around Earth for a while. Astronomers simulated the orbits of mini-moons with a supercomputer and published their work in the March issue of the journal Icarus.
On March 28th, the European Southern Observatory announced new work suggesting that rocky planets, not much bigger than the Earth, are in fact very common in the habitable zones around faint red stars. We have an interview with one of the lead scientists later in the program.
According to NOAA biologists, bottlenose dolphins in the Gulf of Mexico's Barataria Bay are showing signs of severe ill health, which might be the result of exposure to oil that gushed into the water after the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion of April 20, 2010.
A new study published in the journal Nature on March 23rd suggests that memories really do reside in specific brain cells. At least, that's the case in mice. Neuroscientists refer to these as memory engrams.
The World Meteorological Organization, a specialized agency of the United Nations, announced on March 23, 2012, that the decade from 2001 to 2010 was the warmest since records began in 1850. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. This week's Song of the Week is All in Love by Monahans. We hope you enjoy.
Hundred hours.
We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Weather extremes, such as droughts, floods, and heat waves, are on the rise over the past 50 years, fueled in part by global warming. That's according to a March 2012 special report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, authored by 220 scientists and experts from 62 countries. Here to talk more about risks from extreme weather posed by climate change is Chris Field, a lead author of the IPCC report. Dr. Field is the director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University. Dr. Field, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What are the main findings of this latest report by the IPCC?
The first is that climate extremes are increasing, some important extremes, and that includes extremes of high temperature, extremes in the length and severity of droughts, extremes in the amount of precipitation that's falling in the heaviest events, and extremes that are associated with high sea level. The second thing we know from the report is that economic losses from these extreme events have increased. The evidence is that the losses have increased mainly as a result of increased exposure, how much stuff is in harm's way. And the third thing we learn from the analysis is that there are really a lot of steps that can be taken. Steps can be taken now that aren't necessarily very expensive that can make a big difference in both the risk of disasters and in the consequence of disasters once they occur.
Dr. Field, would you step back a minute with us and talk about this connection between what humans do to put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and how that ultimately causes global warming, climate change, and how that is connected to extreme weather? Speak to this to this connection. What do scientists know about it?
We have known for more than a century that heat-trapping gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and other compounds, tend to trap heat that's released from the Earth's surface, and that extra heat that's trapped in the system tends to stay there and make the temperature warmer. The link between greenhouse gases and warming is very, very strong. The link between warming and climate extremes has two components, and this is still an area where the research is newer and where some things are very well understood and some things are much less understood. You know, we can think of temperatures as kind of falling into a bell curve, and if we have a lot of temperatures that occur close to the average and we have a few temperatures that occur at extreme highs and a few that occur at extreme lows. With global warming, if we shift that whole bell curve toward higher temperatures, we actually end up with a lot more temperatures at the high end and a lot less at the low end. And so simply warming the climate will result in more high temperature extremes. A climate system that's warmer essentially has more energy in it, more energy that's pushing air masses around, more energy that's evaporating water into the atmosphere. And that energy tends to, I think of it as kind of squirt out in unexpected ways. And what the climate models consistently indicate is that a more energetic climate, a warmer climate, has more variability on all time scales. And you see that variability in extremes, extremes of high precipitation, low precipitation, strong storms, things like that.
Is it meaningful to ask whether global warming causes these a specific extreme event, like a heat wave or a hurricane?
It's a really good question. And it's a difficult question to answer, mainly because the climate system has a lot of variability in it as a result of the natural function. In science, we can be relatively confident that we're seeing a change in, for example, the probability of a heat wave. One of the conclusions from our recent report is that if we stay on the warming trajectory that we're now on over much of the world, what's currently the hottest condition every 20 years could become the hottest condition in every 2 years, a tenfold increase in the probability of these extreme high temperature events. And that we can say with statistical confidence. If we look at any single heat wave, we could say, well, there's a statistical probability that climate change contributed to that, but we're not at the stage yet where we could, with high confidence, say this heat wave was a consequence of global warming and this one wasn't. We're looking at changes in the probabilities, changes in the risks, but not a high confidence diagnosis of individual events as either being caused by or not caused by climate change. It's very similar to, for example, the risk of driving on a car with bald tires. You know that having bald tires increase the risk of an accident, but it would be hard to say with 100% confidence that if an accident occurs, it was a consequence of the bald tires and not a consequence of the driver being tired, of some distraction, or something else. If there's a key message from the report, it's exactly that. If you know the risk is changing, the smart thing to do is to take precautions.
Dr. Field, how do you want, this report by the IPCC, it's not a report necessarily just for scientists. I mean, it's meant to be used by others. How do you want people to use this report and others from the IPCC?
You know, I think there are really two clear take-home messages from the report. One is that there's a lot that can be done to reduce the risk of disasters and to make us have the capability to cope more effectively with disasters when they do occur. And a second important take-home message is that in the long run, the probability of disasters is going to be strongly conditioned by what we do in terms of these greenhouse gas emissions. So in the short term, we ought to think about preparation and response. In the long term, we ought to think about mitigation.
You've been listening to ecologist Chris Field. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. New evidence shows that billions of rocky planets might orbit the habitable zones around red dwarf stars in our own Milky Way galaxy. That's according to the European Southern Observatory. They made the first direct measurement of the frequency of planets around red dwarfs, which account for 80% of the stars in our galaxy. Here to talk more about these new observations is astronomer Stefan Udry at the University of Geneva in Switzerland. He's part of the European Southern Observatory HARP Science Team, short for High Accuracy Radial Velocity Planet Searcher. Dr. Udry, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What are the main results of your study on planets that orbit red dwarf stars?
Yes, we have a dedicated program searching for exoplanets around these low-mass stars. And we do that with a spectrograph that we have built or that has been built by a consortium led by our institute. And this instrument is the most precise one to measure the velocity of stars. And we detect the planet by seeing a change in the velocity of the star due to the presence of the planet.
Yeah, tell us more about this. Media reports say that there are likely billions of planets that orbit these red dwarf stars. Tell us more about that.
Okay, the red dwarfs are interesting stars for several reasons. First, they are less massive than the Sun, so it's easier to detect the planet with our technique. That's the first point. The second point is that they are fainter than the Sun. So what we call the habitable zone, the zone with the good temperature for liquid water to exist around the star, is closer to the star than in the case of the Sun. And for us, with our technique of detection, we are more sensitive to planets that are close to their stars. So it's easier to detect habitable planet around low-mass stars, these red dwarfs, than around stars like the Sun. And on top of that, those stars are by far the most numerous one in the galaxy. So we have a sample of such stars, we look for planets, and we are finding that around 10% of them, roughly, they are rocky planets. And as there are 100 billions of those stars in the galaxy, we conclude that there are tens of billions of planets that are rocky around those stars in our galaxy. So it's, we are on our way to detect places like the Earth where life could be developing. So all our work is on a road that at the end will lead us to the detection of life somewhere else in the universe.
You've been listening to astronomer Stefan Udry. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky, broadcast on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird is here with news of the global night sky, the first all-sky map of the universe at extreme wavelengths. Welcome, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. Well, as we look at the night sky, we see points of light, and those points of light are stars. And we see them because we see the sky at visible wavelengths of light. But as many people know, the light that we can see with our eyes is not the only light out there.
Oh, it's just a sliver of what's really out there, isn't it?
Yeah, there's this whole electromagnetic spectrum of energy, and light, visible light, falls about in the middle of that spectrum. So the light, of course, you know, can be considered as a wave, and it can be considered to have a wavelength, and the length of the waves can be very long, miles long, and those are radio waves, or they can be very, 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 very short, and those are the very high energy gamma rays and X-rays. And this new map of the night sky, which was done by a telescope in space, has been done in gamma rays.
Yeah, tell us more about this. This is a space observatory launched by NASA, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope.
That's right. It was launched in 2008. And at that time, we only knew of three objects that were shining in gamma rays at the very end of the electromagnetic spectrum. So this is at the very, almost at the edge of the spectrum, at the edge of what our instruments can detect. And since the launch of this telescope, astronomers have discovered 500 more objects that shine in gamma rays and are able to create a map of the sky of things that if you could see with gamma ray vision, like Superman, then you could see these objects.
That's incredible. I mean, tell us about some of these objects that Fermi has found.
Well, there's all kinds of things in space, as it turns out, that emit gamma rays. Our own sun emits gamma rays. But there are other much more exotic objects than the sun. So there are neutron stars, which are very densely packed stars, and they're doing all spinning and emitting jets and doing all kinds of wild things out there in space. The object that I love the most, though, that's a gamma ray emitter, is something that's, you know, relatively close to home, and it's called a Fermi bubble. And so now you have to start using your mind's eye to picture this. But what you're going to picture, Jorge, is our own Milky Way galaxy. So our own island of stars in space. Its vast spiral arms, you know, rotating majestically in space. And we think of it as this island of stars. And yet this Fermi telescope discovered that, you know, protruding from the center of our galaxy, going 20,000 light years in either direction, so both up and down with respect to the galaxy, there are these huge, vast bubbles that are emitting gamma rays, and they call those the Fermi bubbles. If we could see with gamma rays with our own eyes, which of course we can't, we would see those bubbles in our sky. And in fact, they would span most of our sky. Most of our night sky would be covered by these huge bubbles emitting gamma rays. We can't see that because we can't see in gamma rays, but every night that we go outside, those vast bubbles are there.
That's something to think about as you look out into the night sky even tonight.
That's right, Jorge.
Well, thanks for joining us, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us.